Welcome to Legal Talk with Attorney Kevin Flesch of Flesch Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesch Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesch Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesch.
And we'd like to welcome you to Legal Talk, brought to you by Flesch Law. 303-806-8886 is the number. Hey, always a free initial consult. And, I closed our show last week by saying this, and I'm going to start this show. Don't waste that. This can be very valuable. No matter what kind of case you think you have, it's a free call to Flesch Law. Sit down with Kevin. Get his opinion, all right? Free consultation. And we've got our Flesch Law text line. If you ever have a question for him, you want to go over here on the show. That number is 720-201-8585. With that, we welcome Mr. Flesch. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
Busy Very summer?
Good. Busy, busy. It's been good, though. A little hot.
Yeah.
A little hot, but it's been all right. This time of year is always good. We always have lots of things going on within the courts and with the clients. It's sort of the dog days of summer. A lot of people are on vacation, so maybe we don't get things moving as much as we'd like. It seems to pick up after kids go back to school in August, but it's still, we got lots going on and all good things going on.
It's not like, you're in court every day for 360 days a year. You're not, doing just criminal. Every day and every file is so different.
Yes.
You've got three criminal cases.
Right.
They're all vary so much.
Yeah, they do.
So.
Well, and the other thing, like today, I just finished up a case with a, I'll call him a kid, but he's 20, where he got charged with having a handgun in a vehicle and a magazine that wasn't legal either, in the sense that it was a high capacity air quotes,
right,
in Colorado, and worked out a really nice. The gun wasn't operable; it didn't have a firing pin in it.
Oh,
there was
okay.
Lots of defenses relating to the case, and he was pulled over for sort of unusual circumstances. So we ended up having him go through a gun class. Complete that class, and then the DA was willing to, under the provisions relating to storage of guns in your vehicle, there's the criminal component, and then there's a civil component, a civil fine, basically.
Oh, okay.
Saying it doesn't go on your criminal history, but you get fined as if, just to tell you that you got to do it differently the next time. So we got them to agree to give us the civil aspect of it and $100 fine. It was a really good outcome.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about it, though, is the judge almost didn't take the plea because she was so adamant about the fact that the high-capacity magazine, and in this case, the high-capacity magazine didn't have any springs in it. It didn't have the ability to actually hold bullets for the gun. It didn't even fit in the gun that he had. But just the fact that he had that high-capacity magazine, She said, I want to understand why you didn't get convicted of this, or why the DA is dismissing this portion, because she says everyone in my courtroom that gets convicted of this particular aspect of the law goes to jail.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that was really interesting to me. And this, so talking about how you could have different cases and different outcomes, and in this particular case, both the DA and I thought, no problem, she'll accept this, we'll just move on. And both of us kind of looked at each other like, oh my gosh, what did we just step in with regard to this judge? And the fact that I had no idea, I've known this judge for years, I had no idea that she was so appalled and upset with individuals having this sort of situation. And of course, we've talked about this law forever,
since
2013. I mean,
sure.
This kid clearly couldn't have, if it had actually worked correctly, he would have been in deep trouble and he would have gone to jail. I mean, the judge would have said, no, I'm not taking this plea, and you got to set this matter for trial. And so these are the sorts of things that, that's why they call it the practice of law, because you run into things like that where you think, oh, everything's good, hunky-dory, I got this great deal for my client, and then you realize the judge, the third part of this stool, so to speak, may have an opinion about it and may want you to then move forward. And I've had that happen over the years where you're kind of surprised by the response from the court, both positively and negatively, right. With regard to some sort of disposition or if you're able to get the case dismissed, why it's dismissed and that sort of thing. So it does, I mean, it is very much a day-by-day sort of practice in the sense of you get to see different things. And that's, for me, that's why I got into the practice. That's why I'm a lawyer. Because it's, I don't know, it's not like you create a widget, whatever, a
right.
coffee mug,
sure.
and then the next 30 years you're making that same coffee mug over and over again. Because you'd think each case, you know, you're charged with a DUI. How can DUIs be that much different? Well, every one of them are different. I mean, it's really interesting on how facts, because clients will call, you know, well, what do you think after I tell you what has happened? And I'm like, well, I kind of have to see more than what you're just telling me. But secondarily, we got to see the dynamics of who it is involved. Particular counties have particular feelings about particular crimes. And then which judge we have, because then we'll have a better sense of where we're going with it.
Right, right. You know, we did get a text in, and I just now remembered it. A few weeks ago, it came out in the news, and there was a lady that had messed up a lot of evidence with cases.
Oh, yeah. Missy Woods.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. people were asking, what happens to all those people?
I got a case right now. We're going to try to find out.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because there were a bunch of people that may have been convicted improperly.
Sure.
With regard to the way that she analyzed the DNA and whether or not what she said in court was actually fraudulent. And so the difficulty with all of those cases is maybe the outcome isn't different.
Right.
Maybe that the DNA was so clear that even though maybe she didn't do her testing correctly, but the evidence, as long as it's not destroyed, the evidence would still show that the person was involved and that they still committed a crime. But so many times, with regard to this DNA and the interpretation of the DNA, especially where someone is living with another person and where the DNA is found, it really is so gray as to how that DNA affects the case that you have to look at each one independently. And so, yeah, so there's a bunch of those going on because I think they've charged her with 109 or 112 counts. Yeah, so that's individual cases that they have to go back and make decision about. And think about the amount of money that the state is now going to have to spend on reanalyzing all those cases to make sure that they were done right.
How long do they keep that evidence?
Well, for as long as the appeal goes on. Now, if it's a sex offense, and many times it is relating to the DNA, it could be that the person has an indeterminate sentence. So with a lifetime sentence, they would keep the evidence for as long as the person is living. Some of the other cases, it may be, you know, 7 years after the matter is resolved that they then can get rid of it. So that's going to be part of the issue, too, because she was working in that office for decades.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had a number of cases with her and had to cross-examine her over the course of time. So, I guess because I've learned it over time as to how all of that scientific evidence works, it's become more and more clear as to what it is that you have to look at. But I remember 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when we were really starting to see it, just the learning curve on having people come in and explain to it, just asking the right questions.
Right.
Because you don't even know the questions you really need to ask relating to sort of how you go about analyzing what they see and how they, when they have these DNA strings and what they're looking for.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, so to answer the question in the text, it certainly does make a difference. Now, for example, the case that I have right now, the person came in 5-6 months ago. We've been asking for discovery from that case because he was convicted. We want to get all the discovery from the DA's office in Arapahoe. It's taken them 6 months to get all of that evidence to us. So we just got it this week. So now we're really going to start our work to figure out whether or not it makes any difference as to what
right.
the allegations are regarding any fraud.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're listening to Legal Talk, Attorney Kevin Flesh. Once again, our show is brought to you by Flesh Law, 303-806-8886. I always tell you, put that number in your phone. To be honest, we hope you never need it, but if you do, it'll be right there for you for that free consultation. All right, we're going to talk today a little bit about personal injury cases. And Kevin, why is it critical to have an attorney who will take these cases to court, sue insurance companies, and just kind of be, I don't know, right term, but be aggressive for the client, you know?
Yeah, so what we're seeing a lot of, and so there's a couple of, this kind of goes into the weeds a little bit, relating to law firms and the way that law firms do business. Mm-hmm. But what's important for the individual client to recognize is that insurance companies are made so that they pay as little as possible in claims. That's one way that they can make profit. The other way that they make profit is by when they have this pool of money, the investments that they're, you know, the interest or the other income that they make off the investments while they're holding the money before they pay it in claims.
Those make no mistake, they're a for-profit business.
They are for-profit. I mean, there are some not-for-profits, but they're still for-profit. Right. I mean, it's just the manner in which they divest themselves of the profit is different, whether it's shareholders or mutual companies. There are always people at the end of the line that are saying, I put money into this company, I want money plus my, I mean, it just makes sense. And there's nothing, I don't fault them for that in any way. But you have to understand what their reasoning is for being in existence, is pooling risk so that you and I don't have to take on quite as much risk as we want. We don't, you know, so we don't have to set aside $25,000 every year in case we get in a car accident to comply with the statute that says we have $25,000 in insurance. But the point is relating to insurance companies is getting back to, so the law firms, there are some firms that really only want to resolve the case or work on the case up until the point they make a demand, they get as much money as they can at that demand stage, and they settle it, and they move on. They don't want to file suit, it's too cumbersome, it's too much more work, and the time period in which the case settles, maybe another year, in their mind, their model is not set up for that. They want to make their money now. They want to get you treated, get you better, get all the records in place, get that demand out. And as soon as they can get an offer that's even in the realm, even at the low realm of reasonableness in their mind, they're going to resolve it and move on to the next client. And that's just not how we operate. Because what I see with insurance companies, because I know how they operate, half of them, I would say, operate because and recognize those firms in the marketplace, and they're generally large firms with a lot of volume, will resolve the cases that way so that they believe the majority of the time with those firms, they're going to get them resolved. They won't have to go through litigation. Saves them money, saves them time. They can move on to the other claims, and they keep their loss ratios low. Firms like ourselves that know that those insurance companies are out there and they're doing that as soon as you file suit, it goes to another claims adjuster that has more authority, that understands the real process, and will offer more money, then we file suit. I've got a case right now that I filed suit 4 months ago. They wouldn't offer, it was clearly in my mind a policy limits case. It was a $50,000 case. My client had $24,000 in medical expenses. So doubling the meds, that's a policy limits case. Claims adjuster before suit wouldn't pay me even meds. Okay, well, filing suit. Filed suit, claims adjuster. After filing suit, they're like, what do you want? Still thinking they could get something less than the policy limits. I was like, no, policy limits. They got a lawyer involved, in-house counsel for this particular client, but an aggressive guy. I've had lots of cases with him. He worked up the case a little bit, spent a month or two doing some things, asking questions. We had some early discovery. He just tendered the limits last week. So it's that sort of, and it's, you know, $24,000, $28,000 difference. But it's 4 months. It's a lot of money to my client. It's one of those things where if he were with a different firm that was more in line with, we're going to get it done at the demand stage and send you on your way, he doubled his money over 4 or 5 months.
Right.
So you want to find somebody that's going to do that. If you go in for an initial consultation with a lawyer, hopefully you're meeting with a lawyer. If you're not, you're meeting with a case manager that has direct contact with the lawyer. Because some firms, lots of firms that are busy, have individuals that are not lawyers, because those lawyers, our bar cards gets us, you know, we're doing court, we're doing depositions, we're doing other things to make the firm money, not necessarily meeting with the initial consultations. But those individuals should understand and should be able to tell you, yep, we're a firm that files lawsuits. Or they may say, oh yeah, we normally farm those out. So we'll get you up to the demand stage, and then we have another firm that will handle it for you, or we'll have another part of our team, part of our firm that will handle that, which is like another law firm. And then you as a customer have to decide what works for you. Personally, I wouldn't want to reinvent myself for the second portion of the firm or another firm completely having to talk to them about the case and give them an update after you started with the one firm. But other people have different opinions about that. But I think it's important to know who you're dealing with from the beginning so that you know who you're going to end up with at the end of the deal.
Because every firm really has a business model, right?
Well, hopefully.
So to speak.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, where they just...
The
like
successful
say,
ones.
They're not going to... We're not going to go to court.
Right.
We're not going to do this. We're going to settle
right.
what we can.
And,
so.
And you should... When people always ask me in the initial consultation, well, what are things that I should be asking? And then I sort of talk about this. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're shopping around, these are the things that would be important to me, just being in the marketplace. You know, what exactly do people do with regard to the demand? What do you go past the demand stage in-house? Will you be the lawyer that I will see in court with me when we try this case? And secondarily, what are you going to charge me? Because a lot of those firms, that's the other thing that you have to balance. You know, we're pretty flat in the way that we handle. It's either a third or 35% all the way through trial. Other firms will be 35%, 40, 45%, 50%. You know, and you can tell the folks that really don't want to go to trial as that percentage inches up as they get closer and closer to a trial date, right? Because they are not... I think 50% of any sort of recovery by a law firm seems to be excessive to me. But the market has said that people will agree to it. So, but those are the sorts of things that people need to think about when they're deciding on a lawyer. And you've got to talk to, I think you talk to at least three firms. You see who you're comfortable with. Make sure that you feel comfortable with them. Because no matter what the situation, there's always going to be times in your relationship with the lawyer and in the case itself where there's going to be something that comes up where you're going to want to have some professional judgment from the lawyer about the case and sort of the outcome, and then you have to trust their judgment.
Right.
And if you don't trust their judgment from the beginning, they're not the lawyers for you.
Do you think the value changes a little bit when you get adjusters that you've talked to a lot and they know you and your reputation and you know... I will file a suit on. Do you think sometimes that helps?
Yes. The short answer is yes. I would like to think that it doesn't, but it absolutely does. I think the insurance companies talk. I think they have their own brand of email strings and their group chats, just like I know the personal injury lawyers, the plaintiff's bar does, and so that they know the folks in sort of the marketplace that when they say they're going to do something, they're going to do something, and when they say they're bluffing. And so the insurance companies know those individuals.
Right.
And I think over time you get to know, especially if you try a bunch of these cases over time, you get to know the defense bar. You get to know those lawyers. And that's part of what I think really makes a difference too, is having just direct conversations with the lawyers that are now hired by the insurance companies that you may not know the insurance company, but you know the lawyer that's handling the matter, and you can have pointed conversations with them about the facts of the case and what they think, and then you bounce things off of each other. And if there's some level of trust there, you can have a conversation about values and what you think can happen with regard to resolving the case.
Right.
And a lot of times now, with almost 30 years of experience and being in the marketplace, I can call up to one of those senior partners at one of those firms downtown that does a lot of this work, and we can have a conversation because we've had those conversations in the past. Mm-hmm. And it's a fruitful conversation for my client because at least we get a sense of what are we doing here,
right?
Do we have to just prepare this thing for trial, or can we have a conversation about values and where are we? You know, we're always off a little bit because they're relatively conservative in their valuations. I'm probably more in the opposite direction. But then you have a middle ground that you maybe can get to that works for the client rather than taking on the risk.
Right. You're listening to Legal Talk with Attorney Kevin Flesch. Again, Flesch Law, 303-806-8886. So everything changes. The tone changes when a lawsuit's filed.
It does. Yes. Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Everybody gets serious.
Right.
Yeah.
And then that's where your work begins, and your staff, as far as you know, discovery and documents and depositions, different things like that. And
yeah, and the economics change too.
Yeah.
You know, you have to put some money into the filing, you know, filing the lawsuit anymore. It's almost $700 to file the lawsuit with the court, with the jury fee and everything.
When was it when you started?
Oh, my gosh. It was less than $200.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's gone up significantly. But, I mean, that's over 30 years. So, you know, filing, you know, so the filing fees, just, and that's just getting you in the courtroom. That's just giving you the ability to have a jury and to move forward. But you still have to go out and serve them. So there's some process server costs. But where the costs really get you is the depositions, you know, having a court reporter in the room with you, transcribing everything, mediation costs, having a retired judge listen to the case, and they charge hourly for their time, and then experts. The experts are the biggest thing that drives the cost in a case.
Right.
A medical malpractice case, you know, to start, just getting the opinion where you have the ability to move forward with the lawsuit, because you have to certify in the complaint that you've had it reviewed by a medical professional or a professional that's licensed in the same sort of field, and you have, you know, that they've given you grounds for the filing of the lawsuit, that it's not frivolous.
Right.
You know, that may be $5,000 or $10,000 just to get to that point.
Well, I would assume medical people, this is the last thing they want to do.
Yes.
Come to court.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few doctors out there that have now made it a part of their practice and they're interested in testifying, but the majority of them have no interest in dealing with me, nor do they have any interest in being in a courtroom.
Right.
Yeah. And they charge it accordingly.
Right. Run through again how long you've got after like an accident to, you know, get something going.
Yeah.
As far as statute on.
Well, great question. So car accidents, you have 3 years to file a lawsuit. But most of the time, if it's a moderately sort of involved incident where the person is hurt, maybe they've spent 6 months treating, then we can get a demand done in the next 90 days after that. We should be able to get it resolved before a year through the demand stage. If we're not able to do that, then we file suit promptly. You're then in a lawsuit maybe at 15 months. We're setting trial probably out about 24 months. 25 months, and you're hopefully resolving it with some discovery, maybe a deposition, some written discovery, and a mediation, 18 to 22 months out from the incident. And that's your sort of garden variety, but it's your basic sort of soft tissue back injury, 6-8 months of treatment, no real surgeries, no injections, you know, moderate injuries.
Right.
If you've got, like I've got a case right now where the client has been treating for 3 years, almost 3 years. We're filing suit. We're going to get basically an independent medical examination. It's going to be a doctor that's reviewed all the medical records and given us an opinion about future needs for this particular client, so we can do a demand just before the statute runs. And we don't think that we're going to get it resolved, but we want to give it a shot at least for the first at-fault party, because we think it's a policy limits issue there. But if not, we'll have to file suit before client's done treating, because they have such extensive injuries. So there are times, I've got a case that I settled a few years ago with regard to a police brutality case where client was still treating. We litigated that case for 4 years, and they still had ongoing treatment, so we had to continue to update it. So the statute of limitations is not dependent upon when a client gets done with their medical treatment.
Yeah.
So we're always watching that to see. Most of the time it doesn't impact it, but sometimes it does, where we've got to kind of manipulate a little bit what we're doing for demands and putting the insurance company on notice to see if we can get it resolved.
Let's talk a minute about the people that maybe have, you know, it's been a year and they've been trying to kind of work with insurance companies and the adding value, I guess we've always called it, of what you do and
how
you handle those type calls.
Yeah, so the biggest thing where we really help people in the beginning after the incident is making sure that they get good, proper treatment. The problem that many people go through is that they're optimistic about their medical problems and they think it'll just go away. So they don't get treatment right away to document what's happening. And that comes to bite them later, because that's a great defense for the insurance companies to use, saying, well, you were fine 3 weeks, 4 weeks out from the incident, so did something else happen? And they always try to cause sort of the cynical view of that you really weren't injured. So those are the things that we help people with. We also help people in the sense that, okay, maybe it's a two-year, you think it's a two-year statute of limitations relating to a premises liability case, but it turns out that the people that you want to sue are governmental entities. Well, that statute of limitations just went to 182 days because you have to send them a proper notice to the registered agent for that particular issue within that six-month period of time. And if you don't do that, the two-year statute doesn't matter. So it's those things that we can help people with, but it's also just kind of helping people through the process so that they don't step in those landmines, so that they understand what they really have to be looking out for, so we can help them through that process so that when we do have to file suit, everything's in order and it's much more complete and there's corroboration for everything so that it helps them get full value.
And this is something, too. You've always said this. If they got $30,000 on the table.
Yep.
Absolutely. And you decide to take the case feeling you can get more.
Yep.
You let them keep that $30,000.
Yep. I don't take any of that amount of money that was on the table. I don't think because we have an added value relating to that, I'm always willing to take on that chance. And we'll go through it and we'll talk about it. I'll kind of give my assessment after we see what they've provided to the court and whether or to the adjuster and where we can add value. And if it looks like we can get them another $10,000 or $20,000 or $100,000, then we take a percentage of what we can get them.
Right.
And the first money that they come to us with is theirs, and that we don't have any interest in recovering from that.
What hurts a case the most in most personal injury cases? Is it people not seeking treatment or the erratic treatment, you know, where they go a few weeks, they don't go for a month, then they go back? I mean, that, I guess all under that umbrella, that really can hurt a case.
That's the biggest thing. So the corroboration relating to the medical doctor saying, this is what you should have had for treatment, and this is what you did. You didn't follow our advice. Mm-hmm. So then it looks like you're at odds with your medical treating physician. The other thing sometimes that will happen is sometimes clients will feel that they know their own body and that the doctors aren't giving them the best advice, and they don't feel like they need to follow through with what they're saying. That generally hurts them because almost jurors always rely on the doctors. The insurance company relies on the doctor's opinions. And when you don't follow it, it looks like you're not playing by the rules, so to speak.
Right. Pre-existing conditions, got about 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Does that hurt cases?
It can. What you want to do is many times people think, oh, I should go to a new doc so that they get a different opinion. My opinion is you go back to the doctor that you had so that they then can apportion the injuries for us at a later time. Yeah, because they have your history. They're the best advocates for you about saying, this is how you were doing, and you were better. Because they're generally not going to advocate, you were in bad shape.
Right.
I wasn't doing anything for you, right? So they're going to say, no, when you stopped, you were in really good shape. And then they'll talk about the other and help you out through that. So it's always best to really think about those treating physicians that you've had, to go back to them so that they can help us explain everything and tell the full story.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid of it. It is what it is.
Yeah, no doubt. Once again, free consultation at Flesh Law, 303-806-8886. Take advantage of that. And once again, if you ever have a question for Kevin, use our Flesh Law text line, 720-201-8585. Kevin, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to our show next week.
You bet.
Don't go anywhere. More coming back right here on KLZ 560.
Call now for a free consultation with Flesh Law, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886, or visit fleshlawfirm.com. That's FLESCH, fleshlawfirm.com. A proven team dedicated to your legal needs.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
How much do you need to lower your monthly mortgage payment? $200, $300, $400 or more? As rates decline, take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Over 24 years of saving Coloradans money. Low rates, lower payments, less costs. What makes us different is we listen. As an independent mortgage broker, we shop the top lenders to save you the most. Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Want to purchase your next home? You can't qualify unless you sell your current home? Let us show you how to get the down payment out of your current home, qualify for the new one, and then sell yours for the most. Affordable interest mortgage, 720-895-0500. So you want to buy a home. Let us show you loans that can save you money, low down payment, first-time home buyer specials, fixed rates in the fours with buy-downs. Call for details, 720-895-0500, or apply now at aimortgage.net. That's affordable interest mortgage, where it's all about you. Regulated by DORA and MLS 217-147, Equal Credit Lender.
Zip around the neighborhood, commute to work, or ride the trails on an e-bike. Hi, I'm Randy Carancy, founder of eBike of Colorado. E-bikes are electric bikes that are fun and easy to ride. Pedal Assist technology flattens the steepest hills. At eBike of Colorado, we have 14 major brands to choose from, and our expert staff will find you the perfect bike. Just try it. Take a free test ride at eBike of Colorado in downtown Louisville next to the historic grain elevator. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Learn more at ebikeofcolorado.com. Just try it.
KLZ 560, your home station.
Haystack Help Radio brings you Your Legacy, Your Way, the show that puts you in control of your future. Hosted by Scott Whatley and featuring estate planning attorney Carolyn Duncan, this program is your go-to source for everything you need to know about protecting your assets, your family, and your legacy. Whether it's a will, a trust, or a full estate plan, if you don't decide, the state will decide for you. Attorney Carolyn Duncan brings the experience you need to help you gain peace of mind and avoid costly legal pitfalls. So ask yourself, what kind of legacy do I want to leave behind? Don't wait for a crisis before you plan. Now here's Your Legacy, Your Way with your hosts, Scott Whatley and Attorney Carolyn Duncan.
Welcome to Your Legacy, Your Way. My name is Scott Whatley. We are glad you are with us. We're here every week at this time with our exclusive estate planning attorney, Carolyn Duncan. Check out the website, duncanlegal.com. Her number, 303-394-2358. And with that, we'll welcome Carolyn Duncan. How is your week thus far?
You know, it is going really good. Really good. I've been, you know, getting some business in, working on my business. And yeah. Kind of.
That never ends, though, the working on your business, does it?
No.
I mean, you kind of think, you know, you own a business for a few years. You're like, okay, there's got to be a point where I'm not at the top of the ladder or on the roof by any means, but I've kind of where I need to be. But I tell you, just you never know what way the economy is going to go. You never know what things and, you know, is just going on in the world and where people's thoughts are. You're just, you're always trying to figure out the key to the door, so to speak, you know?
Oh, yeah. You're constantly doing that. Matter of fact, I did make a lot of changes. Let's revisit that budget. Where do I need to find, you know, where do I need to add money? What do I need to do? Right. You know, where am I? Mm-hmm. Because I find you can't really operate on that bare bones. Yeah, and I've had to learn that, you mm-hmm. know, of going, whoa, I got to look for more for the future and have that where it's like, oh, kind of deal.
I think what gets harder for people too, and just visiting with friends and, I mean, personally, everything. When you have these unexpected emergencies arise nowadays and you got to write a check for several thousand dollars, I don't care who you are. I mean, it's just like, wow, wasn't expecting that. And, you know,
oh, I agree.
Making it up.
And, you know, I just had to, in my car, had to do the brakes. And we're not even talking the replacement, but hey, it's been this long and the pads are gone and we need to, whatever they do to the rotors. And,
turn the rotors, okay, yeah, they call it. And I'm not a mechanic. I've just heard the term.
It's like whatever they're doing, right, and you're right, like, yeah, going, oh, man, that's $1,800. And
no, it's
there's
crazy.
The rest of the stuff that
right,
went
right.
along with that, like changing the oil, and you're like, going, oh, my
I know.
Gosh.
Yeah, I just came to where I could stop, and now I'm $3,000.
You know, it's like, yeah, you need to change the air filter in your cabin. And I'm like, there's an air filter in my cabin?
Yeah. Where's my cabin? I mean, I've always wanted a cabin. But, you know, hey, when you get in situations like that, if you do that maintenance along the way, it'll save you those big repairs. And, you know, trying to correlate it to this just a little bit. Folks, if you'll pay attention right now, this can ease a lot of pressure for you, your family. And I've heard it said this way recently. I was listening to a guy talk about estate planning, and he said, if you love your family, I mean, he was just blunt. you should have an estate plan, you know, and that's true. I mean, you know,
I think that's true.
It really does help.
You know, I get asked a lot, or I say it a lot, whether you're asking me or not, but, you know, when people come and say, well, what is it that you do? And you say, hey, I'm an estate planner, and, you know, we do the wills, the trust, powers of attorney, probate, and things like that. I said, but what I really do is I sell peace of mind.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely true. Today we're going to talk about something, and we're going to talk about a word you may be familiar with, you may not, and if you've heard it, you may not know what it means, and it's called conservatorship, and that is something that plays in this role in this world of estate planning. So, Carolyn, help us out here today. It's going to be our topic. So, what is conservatorship? What does that mean?
Okay, so when you're thinking of a conservatorship, this is the person who could step in if you're incapacitated and unable to handle your financial affairs. And it's more than just your financial affairs. It could be, like selling the real property and doing things like that, whatever they needed to do. But they're the ones that are handling the money. In Colorado, conservatorship is the money, guardianship is the day-to-day decisions. Not so much that you got to live with the person, but they're making that decision of mm-hmm. where are you living and what's going on. We're lucky in Colorado because we have two very distinct terms for these.
Okay.
I still kind of dealing with it. It's a beneficiary of a trust that I'm doing here in Colorado. But he was just put under conservatorship in Illinois. And what I learned is they call the conservatorship the estate of whatever. They don't even use the word, but it's the guardian of the estate and guardian of the person. And I'm like, ooh, that's really very similar terms.
Right.
You know. But the guardian of the estate is the money and the guardian of the person is the day to day. And I'm going, oh, we are so lucky that our terms are so different.
Right. So is this mainly used when someone's incapacitated?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. Or it could be if you do what I tell parents never, 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 never do is you did not take care of the fact that you had minor children, and now you don't have a trustee or a conservator in place for them when you pass away, and they got the money. Well, then you're going to do a conservatorship for that child. We did one, oh gosh, thank goodness it's going to end here, like in February. And we did it about 6 years ago because the father left a life insurance policy for each child, and any dollar is a good dollar, but in terms of life insurance, it was actually a very small amount. I think they each got like $32,000. So we're not talking a ton of money.
Right.
And you're like, going, well, hey, mom was still alive. Yeah, well, mom was still alive. They were divorced. But she had to become the conservator for each of her sons so she could access that $32,000. And talk about money. She had to do the criminal background check, the financial background check. Because the youngest boy was over the age of 12, or he was 12, he had to be advised of what's going on. He had to agree that his mother could do this job for him. We had to go to court and that he had to say, yes, I didn't have a problem. Then she had to do an initial conservator's report saying, hey, here's the funds we're starting with. This is what we're doing. And then we're doing one every year thereafter. But it's interesting because it's very expensive. And, you know, at the same time, you're like going, wow, that's not that big of a sum of money for all that has been put into it.
Right. So do you get paid? Can you get paid out of the person's money for being appointed a conservator? How does that work?
You can, and trust me, they have public trustees that will act as the conservator, and they are definitely getting paid from the money as part of the estate, because that's the whole thing. It's like you're paying for everyone,
mm-hmm.
Because that's where it goes, and you can really eat up a lot of money really quickly. And the conservator has to be someone that knows, one, they can't touch the money for their own personal gain. You know, mm-hmm. you can't use their money to pay your bills. But at the same time, you have to be mindful that you are making decisions that are in the best interest of the ward, so to speak, and not in your own best interest. And there's a case in Colorado, and it could be probably 5 years ago or now, but I would be shocked if it wasn't still going on. The sister had special needs and all that, and the mother died and left more money in trust for the sister. And then there's the brother, picking on Illinois today, out of Illinois, who was a law professor, right? And so he disclaimed something on behalf of the sister, saying, oh, no, she doesn't need that money. We'll disclaim her interest in it. Well, it turned out the money went into his pocket and his son's pocket, and then someone looking in here is going, oh, no, 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 no. And, I mean, I can't even remember the name of the case, but it's been around for a long time that they actually, at the annual conference, if something's happening on it, I've been to seminars all about this case.
Wow.
And how long it's been going on, and it's like going, whoa, this is how you don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're listening to Your Legacy Your Way with Attorney Carolyn Duncan. Her website is duncanlegal.com. You know, when we talk about incapacity, and we talk every time we get on this, we say this. This is something everybody always thinks, man, I'm not old enough. I don't even need to do this. I got plenty of time. Man, we've seen very young people become incapacitated with an accident.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen older people. You never know. We've seen people that you were walking in and talking with us last week. Great. You go on there. You know, next Friday, they could be incapacitated. You never know.
It's very, very scary. And, you know, I think the older I get, my thinking's changing. And also what I do, my thinking is changing. But, you know, I'm at this point where it's like, going, oh, gosh, I want to live life to the fullest and not regret it. And I need to make sure that I take that me time. It's mm-hmm. not all work time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that there are other people out there doing the same thing. It's like, oh, yeah, we're work, 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 and we play hard, but where are we really doing me?
Mm-hmm. No, you're 100% right there. Mental health means a lot.
It does.
It really does.
It does.
Sure. So we look at a conservatorship, and then we talk about children. You use the minor children, and then, you know, hey, there are people that have some children with special needs as well.
Mm-hmm.
The minor children thing, when I say that, seems easier road to take care of. But then when you get in the handicap situation or with special needs.
You really need to have an estate plan and you can take care of that too.
And there's a lot of unknown with that, right?
Yes. And then the other one you had, and I was lucky in with my father. We didn't have issues with him when I was like going, picking him up one Sunday to go, take him out to eat dinner like I always did on Sundays, and he's getting his shoes on or whatever, and I'm looking at the bills and I'm like going, what are these disconnect notices? And it's like going, Dad, why aren't you paying the bills? And he looked at me and he just said, because I don't use that anymore. And I'm thinking, this is Excel, this is you use this every single day. And I can tell you, I made phone calls that night and said, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to take it over. And I was very fortunate in that my dad did not have a problem with that. You know, every once in a while he'd go, do I still have money? I mean, even when he was in hospice and he was only there a couple of days, that day he died, he asked me, did he still have money to pay for this? And it's like, oh, yeah, you do. I mean,
it is unbelievable how our parents can get, you know, about money, and you're asking, I mean, I've had so many people now, especially since you and I've been doing this show, I say, man, talk to your people over the holidays, you know, and see, try to get them to have it, and they think, we're going to get, you know, we're fine, you know, we're going to put tape on things and put your names on it. I mean, honestly, I had a friend say that, mm-hmm. that's what they were going to do.
You know, but it's even more than that, because I'm just picking on Illinois, but it's the same case.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
Or a different case that's connected to one that I'm handling here in Colorado, and the beneficiary is in Illinois. And he's in his 80s, so if you told me he was, you know, anywhere from 82 to 88, I'd go, yeah, that's probably about the right. They're all in that age group.
Mm-hmm.
And his son applied for the conservatorship in Illinois, which is how I know of how similar they are. And everybody could see that this guy could not handle his financial affairs. I mean, he went, crossed state lines into Indiana, went to two separate financial institutions that he had accounts at, and took out $30,000 from each one of them. And within 30 days, they did not know where that money went, other than he took it. But he didn't have it anymore. And what surprised me about that is that hearing, because this gentleman kept arguing that, no, he did not have a problem, blah, 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 blah. It took like five hearings before that judge finally made the conservatorship for the son permanent, kind of deal. And I'm like, oh, wow. How many hearings does it take? But, you know, they have the right to protest. They have the right to say, I don't have a problem. Well, guess what? Now they're going to have a lawyer. Now they're going to have this. And they get to present their side of the story. Mm-hmm. And we may all see that their side of the story is not reality, but they're entitled to that day in court. And, you know, sometimes it takes more than one day in court. Mm-hmm. You know.
So what happens in a case where somebody, you know, they designate a friend or something as to be the conservator and take over for a child, that person gets, you know, in bad health or something, can't do it anymore. Are they then allowed to pick someone up since they're in control, so to speak?
It depends.
One of those legal answers. All right.
It depends. That's where you have contingencies are written into your estate planning documents.
In the beginning.
Whether it's a will, whether it's a trust, a power of attorney, who gets to select the next person if there isn't one? Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to put something in place that going to court and having somebody appointed is your last resort, not your first resort. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want that to be your first option. So when we do it, we always have that first one, then we have the successor, and then there's a method of going, okay, well, if these two people can't do it, how do we select the person who comes in on board? Right. And so that's where the estate planning documents come in handy, because there is a way, there is a path. If you don't have any estate planning, and the person is saying, hey, I don't have a problem, I can handle my money, and, you know, I don't need this, well, then your only option is to go to a courtroom. And if mm-hmm. you don't have anyone there that can do it, that will step up like a child or someone like that, then it's going to go to the public trustee, and that's one of their roles, is they step in and take over the conservatorship kind of deal.
Now, once a child, and we said minor children, so if they get, and I'm guessing a number, 18 or 21 or whatever.
21.
Are they out from under that conservator?
They are. So that's why, you know, I said earlier, going, oh, yeah, I had to do this for this life insurance. And I think the youngest child is turning 21 this year. And,
okay, so if there's money there,
regardless of the dollar amount.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So let's say, you know, that policy wasn't $32,000, but it was $500,000. Well, you know, you reach 21,000. I'm just going to give you the balance, and it could be $320,000. You know, the law says you're under that until 21, and it automatically expires at that time. So you really don't want to go there. You want to be able to control of going, gosh, 21, that's a little young. Maybe we need to have an older. I try to get my clients to at least look at 25 as the youngest age.
Right.
You know, and I describe different scenarios you can do all that. But, you know, you have to look back and go, gosh, if I was 21 and I received a big sum of money, what would I do?
I might feel like that guy that took the two $30,000 withdrawals and it was gone in 30 days. That's easy to do.
Yeah. You know, that's what I go, you know, fast car, big party. And not that that would have been the brightest solution. You know, but, you know, we're talking about conservatorships, and I think we also need to bring up a financial power of attorney. Mm-hmm. Because I know the ones that I prepare, there is a paragraph in there that says, if I need a conservator, I want my agent under this power of attorney to be that person. And when we initially started with my dad, I literally took my dad and the power of attorney to U.S. Bank and said, right here, right here. And that's how I got added to all the accounts and had the access. That was the easier way. Right. Could I have done it through his trust? Yes, but that would have taken a couple of more steps. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like, let's get in under this power of attorney. And my dad just had to go in and said, yes, I want her to have access to the account. She's going to do this.
Right.
You know, that's the quickest and the easiest. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, depending on what the trust documents say, do I need two physicians to say that he's incompetent and can't do it? Or do I have a panel? You know, what do I have within the documents to determine that you're incompetent? You know, and I don't...
Do different states probably have different
regulations? They probably do. They probably do. And for me, you know, trust documents that I was doing 10 years ago, 7 years ago, didn't have those options of the panel and doing all this. It would be, hey, these two people can do it, and if they can't agree, then, you know, go to a court. And as we evolve over time, it's not so much that you're doing it wrong back then. You've just heard an idea, whether it was at a conference or whatever it was, going, ooh, that's a better way of doing it, because we all grow with what we're doing.
Sure.
You know, but now I put in several in there of going, the treating, I don't even call it physician anymore. I say medical provider, because medical provider now could be a physician. It could be a physician's assistant. It could be a nurse
practitioner.
Yeah,
you're right.
And if we specifically say that a physician must determine this, well, then guess who you got to go find? Mm-hmm. That's not the, may not be the treating person. Right. And so, you know, I think I heard something, read something about that, you know, within the last 3 years, I'm going, oh, that's a better way of doing it than just doing this pigeonhole.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you mentioned the financial power of attorney. Then would there be, let's say, you know, you're elected to be a conservator over these two children. Do you have a medical power of attorney over them as the conservator?
It depends on what's in medical power of attorney,
right.
And it depends on what's in the documents. So if you don't have any estate planning saying, hey, if my child needs a guardian, I want this person to do it, well, then again, you're in a courtroom trying to become the guardian over the person making those day-to-day decisions, which includes dental appointments and medical appointments and things of that nature. But by doing some simple things, and, you know, you're talking about children. In Colorado, we have a delegation of parental rights form that is only valid for 12 months at a time, but you can name who would be the guardian over your child or children for that 12-month period, and you just have, hate to say it, you have to sign a new one every year.
Right.
But, like, let's say you're going on a 2-week trip, and you're not taking the kids with you, or maybe they're going to grandma's for the summer. You kind of want to give them the ability to take the child to the...
Because it's happened.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I'm telling you, people falling off cruise ships, the, you know, car wrecks in other countries, or
I
whatever
mean,
the case is. We've all seen those stories
lately,
on the news.
I've been trying to figure out, well, how does the little kid fall off the railing in between the dock and the the cruise ship? That's the, you know, one that was within the last, what, 4 to 6 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And mom jumped in after her. It's like, what were you doing that she even had that opportunity?
Right.
You know?
So much to think about. But then, if you notice, folks, in just about every answer we talked about here, it all goes back to what's written down.
It makes it a lot easier.
It can't just be, man, I know that's what they wanted. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be written down, because then you're going to be in a courtroom trying to figure it all out, and that's going to be...
You know,
a lot of time and a lot of money.
And especially with your minor children, you want to make sure that you're naming the conservator and the guardianship, and they are two distinct roles. But you're choosing. You know the good fit. If you have to go in front of a judge and the judge is going to determine where they live, well, you know, you're lucky you got a 2-hour hearing, and they're going to try to figure out what's in the best interest of your child in 2 hours. But they don't know your child.
Sure.
They're never going to meet your child.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
very true.
better to take care of it on your own. And, you know, people go, oh, but they're young and this is our first child and we really don't have any assets. And I'm going, yes, you do. Your biggest asset is your child. Mm-hmm. You may not have retirement assets. You may not own a house, but you have an asset.
Right. Absolutely. Once again, you've been listening to Your Legacy Your Way with Attorney Carolyn Duncan. Her number, 303-394-2358. Any last comments on conservatorship, or is that about wrap that part up?
Well, I think that's about it. I mean, you want to make sure it's in your power of attorney. You want to have some estate planning documents. And, you know, do you just got to think about, do you really want to leave it up to the do-nothing plan?
Sure.
In which the law says, hey, anyone can be this person.
Mm-hmm.
I just believe you need to be proactive. It's not only going to give you peace of mind, but it's going to give your loved ones peace of mind.
Right. Let's talk about, we got a couple minutes here. Let's talk about what that initial consult might be like.
Okay.
Someone calls you today, heard the show, says, hey, we need to talk to you, 303-394-2358. What's that 30 minutes look like?
Well, it really kind of depends. What I do is we set it up and ask them, what do you have? Do you have any estate planning documents? Do you know how the probate and the trust works? If you've never had estate planning, okay, let's first look at the probate and discuss what you have now, which is the do-nothing plan, and how you can change it to your better, and talk about the difference between a will-based plan and a trust-based plan, and what does probate look like in terms of that. Just really giving out that general information that they just have some idea of what we're really talking about. Met with someone earlier today, and husband's going, yeah, we need to do this. And the wife's like, no, we need to do this. And I'm like, okay. You know, I think I'll step out for a minute.
Right.
You know, and then at the end, the wife won, and she had some good reasons why she wanted to do what she wanted. But it's really just explaining, here's what a will-based plan looks like, and here's what a trust-based plan looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we get older and we may need some long-term care and all that, introducing of here's what asset protection planning looks like.
Right.
So you are keeping your legacy for your loved ones as much as you can.
Sure. Your legacy, your way. That's what it's all about at Duncan Legal, DuncanLegal.com. Hey, call now for your free half-hour consultation. Once again, the number, 303-394-2358. Carolyn, we appreciate your time. We look forward to our show next week.
I do, too. You have a great rest of your week.
You as well. That's Carolyn Duncan, DuncanLegal.com. Thanks for being with us today for Your Legacy, Your Way.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.